Hello, Boulder and the wider world. This is Philip Ogren from the Sharing Boulder podcast with an update on the quilt. The quilt is coming along. I have sewn the first 5 rows out of the 15 or perhaps 16 rows. I am making this quilt as a little fundraiser for the podcast. I've never auctioned anything before, and so I'm not sure exactly how it's going to work, but I'm thinking I will probably sell it to the highest bidder. Sure. I'd love to give it to the person who would treasure it the most and get the most use out of it. But how could I know for sure? How would I make such a decision? Ugh. I guess I would need to put an application form together and a committee of concerned citizens to help me read through and evaluate the entries. The greedy free market capitalist in me rather objects to all this extra work just so that I will make less money. And yet, what if a bidding war breaks out between a bunch of rich people and it sells for some ungodly amount of money? Then it will probably end up stored away in a cedar chest in a spare bedroom of some second or third vacation home that sits empty most of the year. Or worse, it could end up hanging on a wall in an embossed frame with art gallery lighting. Ugh! This is a real quilt that lovers should be snuggling under, not some never-to-be-used collector's item. I really don't want high society types milling about, sipping fine wine in high heels, asking about the quilt on the wall. But you may recall from last time that there will be 2 auctions, one for the physical quilt and another for the NFT of the one-of-a-kind digital image. The speculative rumors around the NFT auction are getting pretty wild out there, and they are getting harder and harder to contain. But prediction markets are saying that we could be seeing bids as high as $800,000. So here's a thought. I could let the rich people outbid each other for the NFT, while everyone else gets a fair shot at owning the actual quilt. Maybe a raffle would be a great way to let the universe decide who is the optimal owner. To some of you, all of this sewing may look like industrious and productive activity, but I assure you that I could be doing any number of more productive things, like reading Macon Cowell's most recent newsletter, and making plans to speak up for compact and affordable housing at Diagonal Plaza next Tuesday at the City Council meeting. Please see the Boulder Housing Network blog for details. Or perhaps I could be catching up on work-related odds and ends. But I find this activity to be such a satisfying and luxurious waste of time while I listen to interesting podcasts and books that I won't blame you if you see this for what it is, a luxurious self-indulgence. In addition to a variety of podcasts, I am currently listening to 2 different books by alternating 1 chapter at a time between the two. The first book is titled The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible by Charles Eisenstein, and the second is called Seeing Like a State by James C. Scott. I don't think you need to be familiar with either book. The titles speak volumes by themselves, I think, to appreciate the potential for the yin and yang relationship they confer on my intellectual development, the former being a kind of self-help book for idealists who want to change the world but, you know, just need a bit of encouragement, and the latter being a much more somber tome that grounds one in the reality of just how difficult it is to make positive change in the world. But even still, I'm pretty excited about that second book. One of the themes that keeps popping up in the podcast is the need for and importance of diversity. We have stressed this quite emphatically through solemn testimony and repetition. But what does it really mean? Well, we've been a little thin on substance here, to be honest. But Seeing Like a State has a lot to say about this. Quote, radically simplified designs for social organization seem to court the same risks of failure courted by radically simplified designs for natural environments. The failures and vulnerability of monocrop commercial forests and genetically engineered mechanized monocropping mimic the failures of collective farms and planned cities. At this level, I am making a case for the resilience of both social and natural diversity, and a strong case about the limits in principle of what we are likely to know about complex functioning order. End quote. Can I get an amen? But this is not simply a critique of the ambitions of the state, because the same applies to free market capitalism. Quote, as I make clear in examining scientific farming, industrial agriculture, and capitalist markets in general, Large-scale capitalism is just as much an agency of homogenization, uniformity, grids, and heroic simplification as the state is, with the difference being that, for capitalists, simplification must pay. As we shall see, the conclusions that can be drawn from the failures of modern projects of social engineering are as applicable to market-driven standardization as they are to bureaucratic homogeneity. End quote. A central concept of the book revolves around the word legibility, which refers to central planners' ability to simplify a complex world for the purpose of control and governance. For example, how can you implement a taxation system without accounting for who owns what for property tax, or how many goods and services are being exchanged for sales tax, or how much money taxpayers are earning for income tax? But these things are unknowable without the aforementioned heroic simplification that is required to make these things legible. How can you do that without cadastral maps, standard units of measure, or widely used currencies and languages? How can you assess the value of a forest and the revenue it should generate? Central authorities can't possibly understand all the local customs of each region in a country to a sufficient degree such that they can extract reliable revenue without imposing all kinds of simplification and standardization. Often, this legibility, which is frequently coerced onto human systems, results in staggering, catastrophic damage. An example he gives is that of efforts of 18th century Germany to homogenize forests so that its products could be better commodified, measured, and extracted. Quote, German forestry's attention to formal order and ease of access for management and extraction led to the clearing of underbrush, deadfalls, and snags, greatly reducing the diversity of insect, mammal, and bird populations so essential to soil building processes. The absence of litter and woody biomass on the new forest floor is now seen as a major factor leading to thinner and less nutritious soils. Same age, same species forests not only created a far less diverse habitat, but were also more vulnerable to massive storm felling. The very uniformity of species and age among, say, Norway spruce also provided a favorable habitat to all the, quote, pests, which were specialized to that species. Populations of these pests built up to epidemic proportions, inflicting losses in yields and large outlays for fertilizers, insecticides, and fungicides. Apparently, the first rotation of Norway spruce had grown exceptionally well, in large part because it was living off, or mining, the long-accumulated soil capital of the diverse old-growth forest that it had replaced. Once that capital was depleted, the steep decline in growth rates began. End quote. I think the same human impulse to tear down old-growth forests and replace them with same species, same age forests, hoping that such improvements will enrich the state or the company, is the same impulse that replaces traditional urban development, as described in Chuck Marone's book Strong Towns, with regimented zoning codes that favor homogeneity across lot size, and building purpose across large swaths of a city. This kind of centralized and regimented planning results in neighborhoods that lack the diversity required for robust and resilient social structures that can organically address problems like housing shortages, affordability, carbon footprint, and the need for spaces that encourage sociability and community. They are just too static and too uniform to do anything but create neighborhoods lacking character and dynamism, and they are tone deaf to climate change and social inequity. Diversity is essential for resilient and dynamic systems. It disrupts and subverts centralized power and hegemony, and it is demonstrably beautiful. Diversity is not just a feel-good idea. It is a core and essential characteristic of a thriving city.